So, when you look around the world today, you really don't have to look very hard to find conflict, do you?
No, not at all, it seems. Well, everywhere.
Yeah, whether it's politics, culture clashes, or just outright violence globally, we're constantly seeing these really severe symptoms. Hate, destruction, division. And you hear all the commentaries, the experts trying to diagnose these things we see. They point to economics or resources or political
Well, the
systems.
visible stuff.
Exactly. But the source material we're diving into today suggests, well, maybe they're missing the actual root of the problem.
That's precisely it. The core idea here is that all this conflict we see, it's really just the fruit, the symptom, and it all stems from one single universal root problem in humanity.
A root problem.
Yeah. And what's really fascinating is that the cure Jesus offered, 2,000 years ago in the Gospel of John, chapter 8,
Yeah.
it's presented as the exact same cure needed today. The problem hasn't changed.
And it's crucial to understand this root problem isn't something physical, right? Not
Yeah.
something you can measure in a lab.
No, not at all.
Our sources insist this is fundamentally spiritual, which frankly raises the stakes considerably. We're talking spiritual warfare here.
Not just fighting people, flesh and blood.
But against, powers, principalities, these unseen spiritual forces that seem to drive the chaos we do see.
And it exists out there globally, yes. But the source says it's fundamentally rooted right here, inside, in the human heart.
In our hearts.
In every single person. So our mission today is to really dig into this passage, John chapter 8, verses 31 through 47.
Okay.
We're looking specifically at this really tense conversation Jesus has with people described as Jews who had believed him.
Right, people who are already on board,
Yeah.
supposedly.
And we need to unpack why he immediately starts, well, inspecting their spiritual roots, even though they claim to believe what was his diagnosis, what was the cure, because it tells us essentially everything about the spiritual division that fuels conflict.
Okay, let's jump into that first part then, because it is surprising. He's talking to people who've already made some kind of commitment. They're in the temple listening. The text says they believed him. But he doesn't just pat them on the back. He immediately goes deeper, inspecting their spiritual foundation. It suggests something really profound, doesn't it? That belief isn't just a one-time decision like checking a box.
No, it's presented more like a living root system, something that needs ongoing attention, maybe even inspection. It implies that not all initial belief is genuine abiding belief.
That seems to be the core insight here. Why start with skepticism?
Well, the sources point to the nature of the human heart itself. As Jeremiah says, it's desperately wicked. And it's incredibly good at deceiving itself, convincing itself it's okay with God, even when it's, well, spiritually blind.
So on the outside, these individuals look great.
Absolutely. Doing the rituals, attending temple, very proud of their physical descent from Abraham. That was huge for them.
But Jesus seems to just look past all that.
He does. He focuses straight on their inner spiritual state, their actual condition.
And when he hints they might need freedom, their reaction is defensive immediately.
We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. That's their comeback.
They're essentially flashing their spiritual ID card based on genetics.
Exactly. And you have to understand the weight of that claim for them. They're referencing their lineage through Isaac, Sarah's son, the free woman's son.
Not Ishmael, son of Hagar, the slave woman.
Precisely. It's a distinction the Old Testament really emphasizes. They're saying, look at our papers, Jesus. We're legally, physically freeborn. Therefore, we're spiritually fine.
But Jesus just pivots instantly. He shifts the whole conversation away from physical chains.
He does. He brings it to spiritual chains. He hits them with this universal diagnosis. Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin.
Wow. And that word practices is key, isn't it?
It is.
He's not saying if you slip up sometimes, or even if you commit some huge sin. He says if you practice it. If sin is your default mode, your master.
You're enslaved. It's not about how often, it's about who's ruling you. Spiritual dominion, that's the issue.
And that diagnosis doesn't help much if the patient doesn't even know they're sick.
That's the critical danger of the spiritual blindness he's addressing. If you're serving sin, but you're absolutely convinced you're free, spiritually healthy, why would you ever look for a cure?
You wouldn't?
It's like the fish in water, right? It doesn't know it's wet. The slave doesn't feel the full weight of the chains until they actually try to walk free.
So their blindness prevents them from even considering they might need what Jesus is offering.
Exactly. It leads straight to rejecting the cure because they don't believe they have the disease.
Okay, so the diagnosis is stark. universal slavery to sin, often masked by this profound spiritual blindness. If that's the illness, how does Jesus introduce the prescription? What's the cure?
Well, the first part of that cure comes right in verse 31. He says, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples."
Abide in my word. That sounds active.
It is. This is positioned as the direct antidote to that superficial initial belief. Abiding isn't just, you know, mentally agreeing once. It's described as a consistent, regular habit, a process.
A process of what?
Letting the word actively shape you. Your thoughts, that's the head. Your attitudes and desires, the heart. And your actions, the hands. Head, heart, hands.
That distinction you mentioned earlier, passive intake versus active application, seems really important here.
It's crucial. The source highlights two parts to this abiding.
Okay.
First, there's the intake. You have to put yourself in a position to actually receive the word. Reading it, praying, listening to teaching, meditation.
Things these people in the temple were likely already doing.
Probably. They were definitely doing the show up part. But the second part, the really vital part, is application.
Letting it actually change things.
Yes. Letting the word genuinely affect your life. Does it define what success looks like for you? Does it dictate your desires? Does it actually influence what you say and do?
So if your desire for, say, sin or worldly things still outweighs your desire for what the word says.
And you're not truly abiding. Your roots aren't drawing life from it.
And you mentioned the setting earlier, this whole conversation happening in the temple treasury.
Right, in the court of women, a busy place where people brought their offerings, showing what they valued.
So Jesus is talking about the heart's true devotion. Where your treasure really is right there in the place people are physically demonstrating their values.
It's quite poignant, isn't it? Abiding, then, is fundamentally about where you place your spiritual treasure, what you truly value and allow to shape you.
Okay, so if someone truly abides, lets the word take root, what happens?
The consequence is profound. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.
Know the truth. Is that just intellectual information? Like learning a fact?
The source suggests no. It's not like getting a secret password or a magic pill. It's presented as a relational knowing, a deep, growing conviction.
Like understanding something more and more deeply over time.
Exactly. Often described as like a spiral staircase going up. You revisit the same core truths, but each time with greater depth, understanding, and application in your life. Continual learning, continual setting free.
Which leads perfectly into the second part of the cure he mentions, the Son.
Yes.
Verse 32 says, the truth sets you free. Verse 36 says, the Son sets you free. How do those connect? We need to understand the Son's authority here.
Okay, so Jesus uses this analogy of a slave and a son in a household. This would have been immediately understandable in their Roman-influenced context.
How so?
Well, in that setup, a slave, even a trusted one managing the household or tutoring the kids, was still temporary. Their position was always conditional.
They could be sold, dismissed.
Right. They didn't belong permanently. Their status depended entirely on the master's whim.
Okay. But the son?
The son is different. The son is a permanent resident. He belongs there. He remains forever. And crucially, he carries the inherent authority of the father, the master.
So the authority aspect is key.
Absolutely. That's why Jesus says, so if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. He's stressing the permanence and the authority behind the freedom.
Because a slave couldn't permanently free another slave.
Exactly. No slave had the authority to override the master's claim. Only the Son, the one who belongs, who shares the master's authority, could grant that irreversible permanent freedom from sin's dominion.
Wow. Okay, so that ties verses 32 and 36 together beautifully. The truth sets you free, and the Son sets you free.
Because Jesus is the truth, embodied. He holds the authority.
So the cure isn't just about adopting a philosophy or following rules. It's relational.
It has to be. It's not just mentally agreeing, yes, Jesus could set me free. It's actually coming to the Son, the one with the permanent authority, and asking him to exercise that authority on your behalf.
Asking for freedom.
Asking for freedom from the one person who can actually grant it permanently.
Yet, despite this clear path being laid out, the reaction is hostile.
Immediately. And it shows a terrifying symptom of their underlying spiritual problem. They want to kill the one offering the cure. Jesus points it out. You seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you.
It shows how quickly sin escalates, doesn't it? Disagreement becomes rejection.
And rejection spirals into wanting to eliminate the source of the truth. That progression from sin to ultimately murder is a theme echoed elsewhere, like in James.
And it's a pattern we still see, sadly. When the argument can't be won with logic or truth, sometimes the response is to attack the person bringing the message.
It sets up this stark contrast Jesus draws next about spiritual parentage. He says, I speak what I have seen with my father.
Firsthand, eyewitness testimony.
And you do what you have heard from your father. Secondhand information, tradition, his testimony carries more weight because of the source.
But they just double down on their lineage defense.
They do. Abraham is our father, they insist again.
And this is where Jesus gives them that spiritual DNA test, essentially.
Right. He says, basically, if you were Abraham's children, you'd be doing the works Abraham did.
And Abraham's defining work, according to Genesis and how Paul later interprets it, wasn't rituals. It was
belief. Trust. When God spoke, Abraham believed him, and that was credited to him as righteousness.
So their desire to kill Jesus, who is the very word of God in flesh,
is absolute proof, Jesus argues, that they are not Abraham's spiritual children, regardless of their bloodline. Their actions are betraying their claimed roots.
And this is where the conversation gets really ugly, really personal.
It does, because they can't refute his argument about their actions not matching Abraham's faith.
They attack him. Personally.
Yes. They resort to slander, accusing him of being born of sexual immorality. It's a nasty reference to the questions surrounding his conception.
While simultaneously claiming we have one father, even God, the hypocrisy is thick.
It's a desperate classic tactic, isn't it? Attack the person's origins or character when you can't deal with the substance of their message. They try to discredit his physical roots because he's exposed their spiritual ones.
And Jesus shows why their claim loving God, while hating the Son, is just impossible.
He makes it plain. If God were your father, you would love me. Why? Because Jesus is the perfect representation of the Father.
To hate the Son is to hate the Father he represents.
Exactly. He says the rejection isn't because his words are too confusing or illogical. It's personal rebellion. They cannot bear to hear my word.
It's too true. Too convicting.
It seems so. The word itself exposes them and they can't stand it. It hits too close to home.
Which brings us to the climax of this diagnosis, the bluntest statement yet.
Verse 44, Jesus identifies their true spiritual father. You are of your father, the devil.
Wow, no mincing words there.
None at all. And he shows the family resemblance. How? By mapping their actions directly onto the devil's core nature.
Okay, how does he do that?
He says the devil was a murderer from the beginning. What are they trying to do to Jesus?
Kill him.
Right. And the devil is a liar, the father of lies, with no truth in him. What are they doing with Jesus' words, the truth?
Rejecting them, calling him a liar, essentially.
Exactly. Jesus is saying, look at the evidence. Your desire to murder and your rejection of truth show exactly whose spiritual family you belong to, like father, like son. It's the visible proof of their hidden spiritual alignment.
That is incredibly stark. And just to underline his own position, he throws down that challenge.
The rhetorical test. Which one of you convicts me of sin?
A question nobody could answer then or now. His absolute innocence just highlights their sinfulness all the more sharply.
It does. And then comes the final summary, the ultimate reason for their unbelief, their inability to hear.
What is it?
Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God.
Not of God. What does that mean in this context?
It means not born of God, not born again, or born from above, linking back to his earlier conversation with Nicodemus in John 3.
So if you haven't had that spiritual rebirth,
you remain in that state of spiritual blindness. You literally cannot truly hear God's words in a way that leads to life. You can't see or enter the kingdom. That's the fundamental root issue, a heart that hasn't been supernaturally changed by God.
So wrapping this up, the source material seems to boil down the solution, the way to overcome this deep spiritual root problem, into three essential things. First,
we have to consistently abide in his word. Let the truth permeate us, define us head, heart, and hands. Make it our treasure.
Okay. Second.
Second, we must embrace the Son, recognize his unique, permanent authority, go to him for that freedom only he can grant. It's relational.
And third, addressing that core issue of blindness and inability to hear.
Third, we must be born of God, experience that spiritual transformation, that new birth that allows us to truly hear and see.
So, the source suggests this huge division we see in humanity, all the conflict, ultimately traces back to this one fundamental spiritual split. Are we of God or of the devil?
That seems to be the core contention presented here, and it makes you think about how that root manifests today, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, think about it. Not just in overt violence, but maybe in that stubborn, aggressive rejection of clear truth we see sometimes, or the intense desire to silence messengers who bring uncomfortable realities. Could that be a modern symptom of the same ancient spiritual root?
That's a challenging thought to leave people with. It forces you to consider the depth of your own belief.
Exactly. Is it just a surface agreement, a cultural affiliation, or is it a genuine, abiding relationship with the sun empowered by being born of God that is actively shaping your head, your heart, your hands? Does it demonstrate that you've truly embraced the freedom he offers?
That's the question, isn't it? As the scriptures say elsewhere, if you hear his voice today, do not harden your hearts. A call to constantly check our own spiritual roots. We'll leave you to ponder that until our next deep dive.